All right, everybody. Well, welcome back to the Dylan Jamelli podcast. I have an extremely special guest, a man that I admire, and a man that is going to teach us a ton. He is a legend as a lawyer and also in the bodybuilding community. My friends, I want to introduce you to none other than Rick Collins.
Thank you. Thank you, Dylan. Thanks for being my host on this. Thanks for having me on the show. It's going to be fun.
It is an honor and a pleasure to have you on here. So, guys, first, before we get into some really deep topics here that are going to be very intriguing, me and Rick are going to do a two-part series because we have a ton to talk about. So, if you are not familiar with Rick, which I believe many of you probably are, Rick is the man, the attorney for everything in the steroid, peptide, SARMs world. He is extremely well-versed, one of the most intelligent people I've spoken to. So we're going to talk about kind of the legal side of things, experiences that he's had. And then the next episode, we're going to talk about attacks on masculinity. We're going to talk about body imaging, things of that nature. It's going to be an extremely stellar two-part series, so I'm extremely excited. So Rick, why don't you tell everybody kind of about your practice, what you do, and what drew you to kind of representing this type of law? Because obviously there's a million types of law that you could have gone into. What drew you to kind of like the steroid side of things, and so to speak? And I'm really interested to hear what drew you to that.
Yeah, I'm probably the only lawyer in the world that has this very unique practice, and it comes out of kind of my, you know, if there's an origin story, like, you know, every superhero story begins with the origin story, right? Right. And it's funny because, you know, my origin story when it comes to bodybuilding starts, you know, with superheroes, right? Like many of us, I loved comic books as a kid. The hypermuscularity was sort of just, for whatever reason, that was something that I aspired to look like. And so I remember when I was in high school riding the bus to school and seeing for the first time a copy of Muscle and Fitness. And I think it was like Danny Padilla and maybe either Mike Mentzer or Frank Zane on the cover. It was like, wow, you know, superheroes are real, that you can really, there are people who actually look that way. And that was the catalyst for me starting to work out and ultimately go get into bodybuilding competition, competed in an NPC back in the day when we rode dinosaurs to the contest venues. So, I have a bunch of trophies from those days. I walked the walk, you know, lived, slept, and ate bodybuilding when I was in college. I was a psychology major in college. I loved bodybuilding. I've been into fitness my whole life. So that's always been sort of my avocation, what I'm passionate about, what I love to do. I still spend a lot of time in the gym.
Yeah.
And then sort of separate and apart from that is this sort of my other life, my other my vocation, not so much my avocation. And that was as a lawyer. And I went to law school. I was probably the only bodybuilder at that time, one of very few in law school. And there were certain assumptions, I think, that non-bodybuilders make about the meathead who comes to shows up on the first day of class and the first year of law school. He can't be smart. He's going to fail out. He's never going to make it. In reality, I was one of the few, if not the only person, who was there on a full academic scholarship based on my undergraduate grades and my LSATs. But instead of trying to prove my worth and you know, convince them that these stereotypes, which exist to this day, but maybe not as much, were true, I kind of doubled down. I remember going, I had my cap on backwards. I was wearing T. Michael sweatshirts. I was showing up at law school, like doubling down on meathead. But kind of after law school, that was sort of where those two paths completely diverged for a while. Because, yeah, I still went to the gym, but I became a trial lawyer as a prosecutor. So I worked in the district attorney's office as an assistant DA, one of the great places for a young lawyer to learn how to try a case, to be able to it's just phenomenal experience. So I did that for 5 years, learning the ins and outs of criminal practice. And then I went off and started a firm with a couple of partners mm-hmm. to practice law in the private sector. And timing is everything in life, Dylan. It's, you know, there've been books written about how just timing affects the, you know, your journey more than sometimes more than hard work or diligence or who you know. It's really the right place at the right time. And the year that I went into private practice to sort of hang out my shingle for clients to come and hire me predominantly on criminal matters to help them was the same year that the United States Congress criminalized anabolic steroids and put steroids into the Controlled Substances Act. So that was 1990 when Congress decided that anabolic steroids, including testosterone, were such a threat to the public that they needed to be put into the same law with heroin, methamphetamine, cocaine, you know, oxycodone. And they made them Schedule III drugs at that time.
Right.
And it's interesting because the experts or who you'd expect that Congress would listen to, which included the DEA, the FDA, the American Medical Association, and even the National Institute on Drug Abuse, all sent witnesses to Congress and said, don't schedule anabolic steroids. They don't have that. They don't belong in this act with these addictive drugs that cause abuse and dependency. These are not used for their sedative or hallucinogenic or stimulant effects. They're not narcotics. They're drugs that people use for a physical effect. They're hormones. Right. Unlike there's no other hormone in the Controlled Substances Act, but Congress was really, you know, hell-bent on doing something about steroids in sports. And that was really the catalyst for it. In 1988, you may remember that Ben Johnson, the Canadian sprinter, ran the 100 meters in Seoul, Korea, in the Olympics, and beat the American, Carl Lewis. So you got the Canadian beats the American and then tests positive for Winstrol, and he's a cheater. And so the American sports media went crazy, and the U.S. Congress, it was like, what's going on here? You know, now you've got people who are cheating and taking gold medals away from people who are doing it the right way. And it was actually Joe Biden, among other politicians at the time, that really led the charge to crack down on steroids by making them into a controlled substance. And so that's what they did over the advice of the experts in the field. Again, I like to think, I say often that steroids were not criminalized because of what they do bad for you, even though obviously any drug, we all know any drug can be harmful. You know, you take a bottle of aspirin, you know what happens, you don't wake up, right?
Right.
So, you know, people can die from drinking too much water. So there's nothing that's without risk. But that's not really why Congress focused on this solution to it. It was really, really about steroids in sports. It was about cheating in sports. And this was Congress's way of cracking down on the use of steroids in a way that might make an arguably unlevel playing field for people in competitive sports, either collegiate sports, professional sports, et cetera. And the worry that what does this message send down to the children who are seeing these athletes who are now testing positive for drugs? We've got to make a statement to the public. And so they made these, you know, hormones into Schedule III drugs, which, you know, kind of was the catalyst for my private practice. Because don't forget, I had been a gym manager, I'd been a personal trainer, a competitive bodybuilder. Nutrition and exercise were sort of my wheelhouse. I had a lot of friends in the gym community, and suddenly guys who had been using steroids in the 80s and weren't really thinking of themselves as federal drug criminals were now put in the context of that, in the eyes of the law. And so suddenly you had guys like asking me questions, you know, how does this happen? What's going on? What do I need to know about the law? Because they had no clue.
Right.
And conversely, the people in the courts, the people who are actually involved with arresting or prosecuting or sentencing or defending people who are accused of steroid charges, had absolutely no clue about how these things are different than typical recreational drugs of abuse. And so I found myself in a position to really bridge that gap and to be there for the educational process of letting the bros in the gyms know what's going on in the courts, and to know and to let the people in the courts know what's going on in the gyms. And so I wound up ultimately writing a book called Legal Muscle, which was all about steroids in American law, culture, politics, sports, medicine, you name it. And writing a column for Muscular Development magazine, which I wrote for 22 years, on all issues of the sort of the intersection of fitness and steroids and testosterone and masculinity with American culture and global culture and social issues. So during these past 25 years or close 30 years, I've probably represented more people who've been accused of crimes involving the possession, use, distribution, importation, trafficking of anabolic steroids and other related drugs. And I would include SARMs, I would include peptides of different types, I'd include tainted vitamins and dietary supplements and sports nutrition products. I'd include doping cases where athletes test positive for a banned substance. I've probably done more of that than any lawyer on the planet. And because of the, you know, my origin story as a bodybuilder, I love what I do, man. I love what I do. I'm very blessed. I'm very grateful to be able to have this very, very unique, as Liam Neeson would say, a very particular set of skills that make me very effective in helping people. And I, as a criminal defense lawyer, I think most criminal defense lawyers represent people who've done some pretty bad things, you know, right. either economically, you know, stealing from people, defrauding people out of their money, physically assaulting people, sometimes worse, you know, sex crimes. I mean, most criminal defense lawyers represent people who've done terrible, terrible things, and some of them are terrible people. My clients tend to be the kind of guys that you or I would hang out with in the gym, we'd ask them for a spot, you know, maybe like training partners. They're mostly guys who are, and I've represented some women too, but mostly guys who are bros and who have decided that anabolic steroids are something that the risks have been exaggerated, that the benefits have been underestimated. And whether they're using or selling, they wind up running afoul of the law. Most of them have no prior criminal record or involvement with the law. Most of them are law-abiding folks. They're folks who are gainfully employed. Most of them are better educated than the average person. And yet they wind up being, you know, getting caught in these switches. And as an attorney, I'm blessed to be able to be the guy who stands up for them and helps them and shepherds them through this, you know, what can be a terrible ordeal.
All right, man, that's an amazing story. And it's just, it makes it so nice to hear when I talk to people that are doing something that they truly enjoy to do, because it makes you do it to a much higher level. It's not just like going through the motions every day. So for you, it's, I do this in terms of the bodybuilding side, and you've obviously studied the different steroids, SARMs, chemicals, and know about them. And so it's more intriguing. So that's, I love hearing that personally, just to throw that in there, because my dad always wished that I would do what I love to do. And before, you know, when he passed away, I was kind of starting to get into what I was, you know, doing. So it hits home for me. So it's just, it's awesome to hear, man. So I just
thank want you, man. To. Yeah. I think if you love what you do, you can get really, really good at it.
Yes.
Because you're dedicated. You want to be the best. You want to be, and you know, that kind of, I think that mentality is kind of like the bodybuilder's mentality too.
Yes.
Is, you know, you're competitive and you want to really, you know, be better than your peers. And so you want to be the best you can be. And so so I've always dedicated myself to being that and doing that and being the best that I can be as an attorney in these cases. And I love it. You know, a couple of years ago, I wrote a piece about how what I learned as a bodybuilder, as a, you know, being a lawyer and kind of, you know, making the statement that I think I'm a better lawyer for having been a competitive bodybuilder, and that the lessons that you learn in bodybuilding are applicable to really whatever you do, including being a trial lawyer. You know, the lessons of discipline and sacrifice and overcoming obstacles in the context of bodybuilder, it might be an injury. You pull a hamstring, you have whatever. And so you now you have to work, you have to find work arounds. You have to find ways of working around some of these issues and problems. And all of that can apply to whatever you do. And right. And the dedication, the patience that's required. You know, nobody builds a 20-inch arm in 3 weeks, right? Yeah. You know, it's you've got to get in there day in and day out, over and over and over. And it's pain, right? Because nothing grows in a safe space. So and we can talk about more of that stuff in our next interview. But the reality is, if you don't stress yourself, if you don't subject yourself to the as close as possible to the limits of your capacity, if you don't go into the discomfort zone, right. If you're always comfortable, you're never going to grow. And so you have to be willing to put yourself out there, and you have to be patient that it's going to take time to reap the rewards of it. And bodybuilding teaches all of that.
100%. And that's so true. And there's a lot that you can take from something like bodybuilding with the amount of effort and dedication and consistency. That's one of the things I always preach is discipline and consistency if you want to make progress. And we're going to talk about this later, but people depend on steroids, depend on SARMs, depend on them, but without the discipline and without the consistency, just like with your work, you're only going to go so far, and it's right. going to be very minimal. So I have a lot of questions for you in terms of the legal side, and I'm sure that my viewers are going to be extremely interested in this, some for their own personal entertainment and some for whatever the hell they're doing on the side. What do you find are the most prevalent types of cases that you have? Do they involve steroids? Do they involve SARMs? Do they involve peptides? Is it just a mix of everything? What do you seem to run across with the most? Is it like a regular user, somebody selling a bunch of shit? I mean, what seems to be the most common thing that you do? And what is something that maybe would surprise us that you've run into?
So, well, first, you know, I always say in all these podcasts, nothing I say is legal advice. This is all information, and this conversation doesn't create an attorney-client relationship with somebody who happens to be watching it or listening to it. That said, I think it's changed over time. So, sure. and I think it's changed as the market changed, right? Yeah. So if we look back at the 1980s, where were the steroids coming from? What were the products that were on the market? And the answer is virtually all of them were FDA approved drugs that had, you know, legitimate pharmaceutical steroids, testosterone cypionate, enanthate, all the nandrolone, all yep. of these drugs that were diverted from medical practice into the black market for the gym culture. Right. And most of the people in the 80s were more, you know, it was more hardcore weightlifters, powerlifters, bodybuilders, very much a gym culture. It was much more, and bodybuilding itself and working out was kind of more fringe in those days.
To say, well, there was mainstream. No internet to sell shit online.
There was no internet. So, yeah. Right. So when you think about it, you know, most of the interactions, you know, that occurred and the transactions that resulted were in the gyms, yes. in parking lots, in yes. person, hand to hand, right? There was no internet. You couldn't go online and buy anything. It didn't exist, right? Yes. So when the law went into effect in 1990 or 91, it was passed in 90, went into effect in February of 1991. Once that happened, the market changed because the response by Big Pharma seems to have been like, all right, these things are now controlled. They're a headache. There's a problem. The DEA is looking at these things. There's abuse going on. There's dependency going on. And so Big Pharma kind of really scaled back its production. And so you had sort of the supply from Big Pharma diminishing. Right. So now pharmacies were really not as involved. And also doctors kind of stepped away from the equation because doctors now, oh, this is a controlled substance. It's like prescribing somebody, you know, oxycodone or cocaine. So, right. So you had doctors kind of pull themselves out of that equation. And the years that followed really, you know, had the traditional sources of supply and information disappear, including the supervision and monitoring of doctors. And what happens, you know, economics 101, when you have demand, there'll be supply.
Right.
And so back then, if you remember, there, you know, it was an opportunity for the Mexican pharmacias and laboratories to start making large amounts of anabolic steroids, calling them veterinary drugs. So you'd see like pictures of various animals and farm animals and pets on these labels. And so that became the market. And so they were being made maybe under less quality control in Mexico than it would have been if it was an FDA approved product, but they were still being made in large facilities and then either smuggled over the border by, you know, mules or in some way gotten into the country here and then distributed again through mostly hand-to-hand interactions. You also had people who were getting cattle implants and taking the trenbolone out of them, you may remember.
Yeah.
So you had these like, which is kind of, the Control Act was supposed to like control the black market, but it really did the opposite, right? Suddenly you went from FDA approved products into people, you know, taking the trenbolone out of cattle implants that go into like a cow's ear. So, you know, you had things become perhaps less safe because the products are no longer FDA approved and because doctors have sort of extracted themselves from the equation.
Right.
And then the internet came along. And so the internet now made it an opportunity for people to just with a few clicks on their keyboard, go to a website in some overseas place and buy steroids and have it sent to their home.
Right.
And so you had this radical change in the way of accessing these drugs. And then along came 9/11. And 9/11 really changed the level of scrutiny that the government gave to international mail parcels.
Right.
And as I'm sure some of your viewers know, there's a difference in the constitutional protection in an international package versus a domestic package.
Right.
So if a domestic package of, let's say, drugs or steroids is mailed from, you know, one person to another, if it's intercepted, the federal agents have to get a warrant in order to open it. There's a protection. They need a warrant, probable cause to support a warrant to open that package. With international, somebody in another country mailing a package to somebody in this country, they don't need a warrant. They don't even need probable cause. They need some good basis for opening it up. You could kind of analogize it to when you come through the airport from another country, they can search you, right? They don't need probable cause. They can, you've seen the 75-year-old men in the airport, you know, with their arms out being searched by TSA agents. They can do that. There's a much lower standard. So that's true with international packages. Somebody's mailing you a package from overseas and that's got steroids in it. They don't need a warrant to open it up. And so when September 11th happened, the aftermath was a much higher level of scrutiny over those international packages. And when they were coming in, they go through scanners at JFK and the big ports of entry, and suddenly the customs folks are finding these packages filled with vials and pills, right, and they start to figure out what it is. And so in those early years that followed, I had a lot of cases involving international packages that were seized when they got to this country. Wow. And so I would represent the guy who orders, you know, his gear from Thailand. Let's say you may remember there was a tub of the Thai version of methandrostenolone, yeah, Anabol, those, yeah, little pink pentagons of Anabol.
Yeah.
So they would order like 1,000 Anabol in a little tub, and it would come from Thailand. And customs would see it, they'd scan it, they'd open it, they'd see that it's steroids, and then they'd have a choice, well, what do you do with it? Sometimes they would send a seizure letter, which, right, means they'd send it to the guy and say, hey, we've got your steroids. We opened a package, and lo and behold, there they were. If you think you need them and you have a legitimate basis for that, let us know. Respond to this letter, and, yeah, we'll work it out, right? And most people just ignored it, threw it in the garbage. But they didn't always do that. Sometimes they, if for whatever reason, maybe there was prior packages that they have in their mail database of international parcels, or maybe it was 2,000 Anabol, or for whatever reason, or they find out the guy had a criminal record. Whenever they made the decision that they wanted to take some action on it, they would get a judge to sign what's called an anticipatory search warrant, and they would do what's called a controlled delivery, which means that somebody gets dressed up, a law enforcement agent, making it look like the person is a mail carrier, and shows up and gives it to the person, usually rings the bell, gives it to the person whose name is on the package. Meanwhile, there's 15 federal law enforcement agents hiding in various places around the house. Wow. That package gets accepted. The guy takes it in. Sometimes when he opened it, it would trigger an alert, which told them the package has been opened. Sometimes they'd come in even without that. And the next thing you know, there's 15 federal law enforcement agents, typically a combination of DEA and sometimes local task force people, who would now basically ransack the house, go through the house looking for evidence, looking for steroids, looking for a computer, looking for a phone, looking for anything that might connect to that steroid transaction. I've seen them seize bodybuilding magazines as evidence to show that this is not accidental, that the steroids show up at this guy's house, right? Wow. So they would typically search the home, and that guy would then get charged either federally or sometimes in state court with the possession of those steroids. And I used to get a lot of those cases. And one of the problems with those cases, getting back to that sort of disconnect between the users and the courts, was that some agent and prosecutor would look at, let's say, 1,000 tabs of Anabol and say, in his mind, this is like 1,000 tabs of ecstasy. Shit. So this guy is like a major dealer. We've got like the Pablo Escobar of, you know, this, you know, Chevy Chase, Maryland.
Right.
And so the next thing you know, the guy is charged as a trafficker.
Right.
And the dude's like, you know, this is my cycle. This was the minimum amount I could order from that Thai Anabol website. And this is enough for, I was going to do a number of cycles. And obviously, as you know, steroid users don't use in the way that traditional narcotics users. So you're not, like, if you're a heroin addict, you're going out, you're jonesing for some heroin, you go out, you buy your heroin, you go back, you use the heroin, you fall asleep, you feel good, you wake up, you go, you get more heroin, right? Right. So it's just a constant small amounts over and over. Steroid users are pack rats, right? You know, they plan out a cycle. They plan out 2, 3, 4 cycles. They're planning cycles, you know, months, sometimes years in ahead, right? So they never want to get caught without gear in the middle of a cycle. So you need all of the gear for the whole cycle. And right. as you know, polypharmacy is what everybody does, right? It's not one thing. So it'll be some testosterone, maybe some DECA, maybe some Tren, maybe some orals here or there, but mostly injectables. And so you're going to see sometimes a steroid user, when they get that 1,000 anabols of 1,000 tablets of anabol, when they go through the house, they'll find Trenbolone. They'll find testosterone. They'll find Nandrolone. They'll find Arimidex. They'll find Clen. They'll find all these other things. And to the untrained eye of a law enforcement agent who really does mostly heroin and meth cases, this looks like a warehouse. I've seen the quote written down. We've got a whole pharmacy in here. You know, they're thinking this is like, you know, the guy who's supplying the world with steroids. And it's just some dude who's got, maybe he's overly aggressive in his, you know, doses, but it's a one man thing. So I would wind up getting involved in a lot of those cases representing that guy. And sometimes he'd already have a lawyer, and the lawyer had no clue. So the lawyer is like, well, the agents say you're a big time dealer. What do I know? I'm not going to challenge that. I don't know anything about this. So I'd either get brought in as a consultant or a replacement lawyer. And so I would be able to make the arguments and show to the prosecutor and to the agents, this is personal use. So that distinction between personal use and trafficking can mean the difference between going to prison and maybe getting probation or community service or something along those lines. So that was a lot of what I did years ago. But as more and more seizures of the finished products happened, and this is sort of like a little history of the steroid market, I guess.
Right. You
know, as that crackdown continued on finished products, ultimately the market morphed again into what it really is now, which is nobody's really ordering finished product from overseas. Chances of getting seized is too high. Right. So what's happening is that people who are the underground UGLs, the underground lab guys, the cook, so to speak, is ordering steroids in powder form, the raw powder, typically from China, having it mailed here in international mail, maybe mislabeled as creatine or yeah. some innocuous thing, having it sent to a remailer who it has a clean house. So if it is seized and there's a search warrant executed, there's nothing in the house to show that this isn't just some mistake of somebody who mailed it to the person accidentally. Once it's securely in the remailer's house, that person then sends it over to the cook in protected domestic mail or brings it to him.
Right.
And the product is made in somebody's kitchen from, you know, the raw powder. Vial put into, you know, esterified, put into vials. A home printer can be used to put the label on. You pick a name, you know, Dylan's Best, whatever. And then it's typically, marketed on social media,
right?
Which is where most transactions occur now, right? Even websites are obsolete at this point. So it's really now a different game. So you don't see the personal users arrested as much as I used to because the market has changed. But I do represent a lot of underground lab guys when they get caught. It's harder to catch them because of the way they're accessing it. But, you know, all you need is one person, you know, somebody who is a customer who gets his own arrest and is looking to work that off. And so, you know, you've got informants are typically used throughout the, you know, controlled substance world by law enforcement to make cases. I've seen people arrested for all sorts of messed up reasons. I've seen a number of cases where the wife or girlfriend catches the gear user stepping out and calls the police and says, "This son of a gun, you know what he's doing? He's got steroids." I can show you. Here's a picture of all his steroids in his room. I've seen people arrested for that, right? Wow. So, you know, so I've represented a lot of personal users, and I still, if anybody is in trouble for personal use or because they failed a drug test, let's say they're on probation or they're a cop. I've represented a number of law enforcement officers and firefighters who were subjected to steroid tests, doping tests, and failed. And then, you know, they're looking to take away their job. I represented a cop once who failed a steroid test because he tested positive for clenbuterol. And I'm like, wait a minute. The policy of the department is don't use steroids or growth hormone. That's right. Right. So he tested positive for clenbuterol, which is a beta 2 agonist.
Yeah.
You know, a bronchodilator used in some countries. We have albuterol here. Clenbuterol is used in other countries, may have a stimulant effect, but that's neither a steroid or growth hormone.
Right.
But we have a zero tolerance policy. I'm like, zero tolerance for steroids and growth hormone? Yes. But this isn't steroids or growth hormone, but we have a zero tolerance. It was this bizarre circular conversation that drove me crazy. Ultimately, I had to try the case. I spent a week in the trial room trying the case, calling witnesses. The city called witnesses. We went back and forth. He was ultimately exonerated because it was an insane case. But it shows that even this wasn't that long ago. And it shows that there's a continuing kind of information, disconnect on the part of some of the people who should know better. And that was, that was a messed up situation. I represented the number one ranked middleweight boxer, Sam Solomon, a few years ago when he tested positive for a banned substance. And so I've done a lot. That was in a German case. It was in Dusseldorf, Germany. So, but now it's mostly underground lab situations. And for whatever reason, lately, in the last 6-8 months, a number of SARMS cases have come to me. It seems like FDA, don't forget, DEA deals with steroids, right? Because it's a controlled substance.
Sure.
SARMs, selective androgen receptor modulators, which we can talk more about, but they're not controlled. So it's the FDA that is in charge of policing the SARMs market. And for whatever reason, lately, they've gotten a little more aggressive. I've gotten a number of SARMs cases, more than I've had before in a higher volume in a shorter period of time. I've probably handled more cases involving research chemicals than any other lawyer. And by research chemicals, as you know, there's a market where these websites will say these products that we're selling are for research purposes only, not to be used for human use. And that would make them chemicals and not drugs, if that was really what they were about. The
right.
problem is the devil's in the details. And so if the government can find enough facts that support that not for human use is more of a wink to avoid it actually being labeled a transaction involving drug. And by drug, I mean drug is defined in the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act as something to affect the structure or function of the body other than food, something you ingest for those purposes. Well, the reason you're saying it's not for human use is, you couldn't sell it for human use because you're not a pharmacy. It's not FDA approved. So those guys wind up getting jammed up, and I've handled a lot of those cases. And there are some very unique issues that come up in those cases, which are, unfortunately, most lawyers have no clue about. And so I've gotten very, very good at handling those cases, and very effective at keeping people out of prison on those cases. I enjoy a lot of the issues that come up in those cases, but those are sort of the areas of what I do. I also represent, kind of like my practice has expanded to basically a broader fitness and supplement related practice. I represent a number of sports energy and dietary supplements, sports nutrition brands, on preventing them from doing things that would be problematic to either the government or to plaintiffs' class action lawyers who are always looking to file a lawsuit if they can find a way of, you know, squeezing some money out of a company that's trying to do the right thing. So, so I do a lot of that work as well. But like I said before, you know, I love what I do. I'm kind of where exercise, nutrition, and, you know, fitness intersect with legal issues.
Yeah. All right. I've got several questions here. I'm going to do the steroid side first because I got a ton of SARMS questions. And as I've, you know, and I've told you, my background is in all of this, but I've been kind of known as a SARMS guy for the past decade because that's where I put a ton of my studies.
Right. And,
you know, I've done like marketing rep work, so to speak, where you kind of recommend a company, they give you some free, you know, products and shit like that. And I've done that for years and written reviews and things like that, even for steroid places. You know, you don't really try to make a living off of that or anything, but you just kind of fun and just something that I've done to help build my channel. So I'm very intrigued. In terms of the steroid side, so a couple questions, like, because I've run into a lot of guys that do UGLs that have always tried to send me shit. And I'm like, nah, I'm good. You know, like I've tried some things, but it's like, I'm good. Maybe I'll try a couple of things, and I don't cycle anymore. So I don't, but there are so many of my viewers do. So I guess my question on the UGL side is what kind of, and obviously this is a case by case scenario, depending on how much, how wide it's going. And, but what is a, because it's clearly a felony as a Schedule 3. Is that like a C felony, B felony? And what do you tend to see in terms of penalties that are imposed or recommended? And do people tend to get off? And do they go after the little guy that's making, because, you know, kind of like when it comes to busting a drug dealer, they kind of try to go after the little guy to get the bigger guy. Do you see a lot of that? And then what kind of penalties? Is it always federal? Is it state? You know, because a lot of times federal and state based upon drug charges is the scope, the land of the scope. Is it international or not, interstate commerce or whatever it's called? And then how large is the distribution chain and everything? So what kind of scenarios do you run into and what are the penalties like?
Right. So obviously every individual state has its own laws. And sure. So in almost every state, there's some kind of law that makes steroids criminalized for non-medical purposes. And so, so those laws apply as well as the federal law, which applies in every state separate from that. The feds typically, in order for them to take a case, it usually requires some high, you know, some level of exposure for prison time. So okay. The guy who's got, you know, 10 vials of Deca is never going to be prosecuted. Even if he sells it, he's never going to be prosecuted for the federal charge.
Right.
He may get dumped into the state. And that's what happens for the lower level cases. Sometimes the feds will dump it into state, although, you know, there's always exceptions. Many years ago, I had a guy who was a pilot who came back across one of the land borders in Texas with some gear, personal use amount of gear, and he got caught at the land border, and they prosecuted him federally for that amount of, you know, fairly low amount. I was able to find a way within the federal law to actually get the case resolved and dismissed without him actually getting a criminal conviction, which was important because he would have lost his job as a commercial
sure.
pilot. So it would have been the end of his life for something, for a stupid little, you know, jaunt to Mexico and picking up some stuff for some fun kind of thing.
Right.
So, but usually you'll never see a low level federal steroid case. And,
right.
you know, the punishments in federal court for steroids are based on the amount of the steroids. So in federal court, the number of units of steroids determines the prison exposure.
Got
and
it.
The definition of a unit has changed because years ago, prior to 2006, 2007, the unit was defined as 110 cc vial. So a vial of test sip, let's say,
right.
was a unit, right? So you have 100 vials, it's 100 units. And for pills, it was 50 pills is one unit. So you have 100 units, 100 Anabol tablets, that's two units.
Got it.
That was changed. And I was actually one of the experts and consultants who was part of the process. I was called by the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers to explain the sort of the realities of how people use steroids to stop an even worse recalculation, which I was able to do. But because there was some talk about removing any cap, so a large amount of anabolic steroids could have subjected you to, you know, 10 years or more in prison. Wow. So, but the guidelines were changed so that now there's, you know, one half of a cc of liquid is a unit. So that means that 10 cc vial is now 20 units instead of one unit. Okay. Man. And one tablet is a unit. So instead of 50, it's down to one. So when you do the math, if you've got, let's say, 1,000 vials, let's say you're a trafficker, you've got 1,000 vials and, you know, 10,000 tablets, the difference between pre-2006 and today is night and day. Because the more you have, there's a chart, and the more the number of units, the higher the exposure. So so typically the exposure caps out at what's called a level 20. And maybe for a person with no prior criminal history, which also makes a huge difference in terms of what your sentence is, right? If you've got prior arrests and convictions, you're looking at a substantially higher potential punishment than if you're, you know, a guy with no prior criminal record at all. But the, you know, typically you can be looking at 3 to 5 years as a, you know, kind of a maxed out in the guidelines trafficker. And certainly there's more facts that can even increase you in the guidelines. So if you're using premises for the drug trade, that can enhance your exposure. If you're selling to athletes, that enhances your exposure. If you're selling to kids, that enhances your exposure. If you are in leading or managing other people to do things, even, hey, Dylan, go in here, drop these packages off, help me put these labels on. Now you could get a role in the offense or leadership enhancement. So there's all ways that you can bump, you know, the government can bump up where a person falls in the guidelines. My goal in every case is to keep a client out of jail, right? My goal is always, because these are people typically who've never been to prison before. They're law-abiding people otherwise. Many of my clients have families, have kids. They're gainfully employed. Without them, they, you know, their family would fall apart. So that's always my goal. And so so that's in federal court. State courts vary, and the exposures can be different. Typically, if it's a small amount of steroids, in many states, there are now programs where, like diversion programs, where if you follow certain rules and your attorney knows is good at what he does, he can keep you out of prison. In return, you'll be in like a community service, a diversion kind of program. Sometimes it involves drug treatment classes, including group classes, which is interesting because, you know, I've heard from so many clients who, you know, the guy he's shredded, you know, he's, you know, meal prepping. He doesn't put anything in his body. He's doing all the right things. He's immaculate in all of his, you know, he's exercising, doing his cardio. And now he's sitting in a room in a circle with people who are like heroin addicts, meth heads, and who are what lost their jobs and maybe they're homeless because they were addicted and their lives fell apart. And this guy's like an overachiever, if anything.
Right.
And he's thinking, what the hell am I here? Well, this is, you know, this is the apple in the orange crate of the Controlled Substances Act. And so so I do hear that a lot. But that's kind of a broad array of the sorts of cases that I have.
Got it. Did they tend to kind of look for certain things on, because I mean, like what you were talking about earlier, the fucking social media thing blows my mind. The way that people are so blatant and just are like, here, Venmo me and cash at me. And I'm like, dude, like, what the? I even cut a video on this and made a video about it. Like, one, I would steer clear from them because you have no clue what you're getting. Not that you have some great clue with UGLs, but it's a lot better than a random social media guy that's like 23 years old that's just like, here, take this shit.
Yeah.
Do they kind of, do they have certain targets, and do they look for people like that make recommendations, or do they look for people that are like low time sellers that to get bigger people, or is it just kind of all over the place?
It's kind of all over the place, and so is the quality control. Like when you say that, you know, when I represent people, I typically either see the premises or either in real life or in pictures. So I see the lab, so to speak. Right. And I can tell you, and obviously I speak to the clients about their practices and everything. And so there are certainly clients who are meticulous. They're fastidious in their quality control. Look, it's never going to be the same level of good manufacturing practices you're going to have in a clean room in a pharmaceutical environment. But these are guys who really are very, very careful to make sure that the product is as close as it could be to pristine. And then I have clients who are not so good with quality control. Guys who, you know, if you saw where these products are being made, and you're thinking to yourself, you're going to inject this into your body, it's terrifying, right? And I've even had situations where the finished product, like peptides, came from overseas. And so the peptides come in, and there was a code. They're not labeled, right? Because you don't want them seized. International mail, you don't need a warrant, like we just talked about. So there'll be like maybe an email or correspondence that the blue caps are one peptide and the green caps are melanotan too or something. So the client just got mixed up about what was what. So people who were buying a peptide thinking that they were getting that peptide were getting at best a different peptide. So, you know, you have these situations where, you know, if people are not being very careful, who knows what you're getting as a customer?
I know.
In these sorts of situations, you know, and this goes back to what we started talking about. And that is, you would think that government policy, to me, if Rick Collins was the steroid czar of America, right? And, you know, if some future president made me that, you know, I would want policy that reduces harms, right? Certainly with narcotics, okay, yes, heroin, fentanyl, people are out on the street, you can lose your job, now you're homeless, your kids are neglected. Those are major, the societal, you're committing crimes, maybe you're trying to get, you're addicted to heroin and you're knocking over a liquor store for money. That doesn't happen with steroids. Those aren't concerns. Nobody's ever knocked over a liquor store for anabolic steroids. Never happened, right? So we don't have the sort of social blight that comes from other drugs. So when we think about dangers, you know, we don't want kids getting steroids, right? I mean, we don't, you know, so we want to control that. And we don't want people hurting themselves, right? We want people to be safe. We don't want, you know, harm to come. So to me, harm reduction should always be a centerpiece of any drug policy.
I agree.
And when we use prohibition style laws, like we've done with steroids, that isolate doctors, take out the pharmacists, remove the pharmaceutical companies from the equation, and now we've got these guys who are making it in their kitchens and selling it, and guys aren't getting medical advice about the products and don't know even 100% what's in the product, you know, we're actually escalating the harms. So the harms are worse than before we put these prohibition style laws into place. And I always say, we should have learned our lesson from alcohol, right? We prohibited alcohol. And what happened? Did it make everything safer? No. We suddenly had organized crime came in. The Al Capones took over. People were making products in their homes, right? So yeah. You had bathtub gin that people were dying from. So you actually sometimes escalate the harms. To me, harm reduction should always be part of what you're doing. You know, when back in the 80s, you know, it was less prevalent for kids, you know, because very often it would be a pharmacist, a friendly pharmacist who would be backdooring some of those products out the side of the mom and pop pharmacy. And he wouldn't give it necessarily to a 14-year-old or a 15-year-old. If that 15-year-old's online, nobody can screen what that person's age is. And so the risks are actually higher now, I think, than they were before the law went into place.
What about the places that like are all international? I mean, a lot of places that have been around for a long time. I'm not going to drop names or anything like that, but there's a lot of international sellers and a lot of people still do go that route. I think not as many as before when there was a far less domestic option, but there's still quite a few out there and a lot of people are aware of what, I mean, obviously, the laws are different over there in that they're subject to their own laws. So is there really anything that we can do here? Do they do anything to them or they just kind of seize the package and possibly go after the person buying it?
Yeah, it's very, very rare that you see somebody arrested overseas for crimes, you know, for sending steroids here to the U.S. I think the last I remember British Dragon. If you remember a number of years ago in Thailand, you know, but they're few and far between because different countries have different laws. You know, the U.S. tends to be more draconian in its drug laws than many other places, particularly with respect to steroids, because even in Canada and the U.K., as you probably know, possessing steroids is not a crime if it's for personal use. So it's really the trafficking or the possession to traffic or distribute that's the problem. So right in Canada, in the UK, you know, only here in the US of those countries is it a problem. In Greece, as I understand it, you can go into certain places and buy anabolic steroids. In Thailand, you can buy anabolic steroids in, you know, without a prescription in a pharmacy. Mexico has different laws. So it's harder to prosecute people in countries where the laws are different. And there's these sorts of jurisdictional issues and just the practicality of getting somebody from that country here, getting the authorities there to cooperate makes it hard. So you don't really see it as much in that context.
Right.
You know, you usually see it, you know, people here. But you know, it's funny. I remember a case a couple of years ago. It's been probably 15 to 20 years ago, where a guy from up here in the Northeast went down to Mexico for a little R&R, bought a good amount of steroids for himself and his gym buddies. You know, probably, you know, certainly more than personal use, but not, you know, not the Pablo Escobar distributor of the Northeast. And was coming back through Mississippi on a highway that I suppose was probably often used for drug traffickers with narcotics coming back from Mexico. And suddenly he sees the lights go on behind him of a trooper. He pulls over. He's got all the stuff in the trunk, variety of different steroids, including Winnie. And the trooper comes over to him, Mississippi trooper, sees that he has, you know, plates, New York plates on the car, which is probably the main reason he got stopped, right?
Sure.
So guy rolls down the window and the trooper says, "Where are you coming from?" "Oh, I was had a wedding or something and weekend thing in Mexico." "Okay." Trooper says, "You have any drugs in the car?" The guy says, no, nothing. Nothing to declare? Nope. Nothing in the trunk? Nope. Pop the trunk and let me take a look. Gosh. So the guy is actually an educated guy, and he says, "I would prefer not to." I don't consent to a search of my car.
Right.
And which is a valid thing to say. So the trooper says, well, if you don't consent to the search of the car, I'm going to call a canine unit that's going to come. It's going to sniff around. And if there's drugs in the car, it's going to go poorly for you. Are you sure you don't want me to search the car? Yes, I'm sure. So he goes, okay. So he calls the canine unit. 20 minutes, my guy is sitting there asking, am I free to leave? Because if I'm free to leave, I'd like to leave. No. You're being held. You're being detained until you're not under arrest, but you're being detained until the canine unit arrives. So while they're waiting for the canine unit, the trooper is still trying to kind of bully him into opening that trunk and saying things like, well, when that dog gets here, I got to tell you, that dog is mean dog. That dog bites, that dog scratches. We'll try to hold him back, but no telling what he'll do. I've seen him destroy the paint on a car, just destroys it. This dog gets crazy. You sure you don't want to? I'd hate to see your car really ruined. You sure you don't want to let me go in the trunk?
Wow.
But the guy holds his own. He stands his ground. He says, no, I'd like to leave. I have nothing to declare. I've done nothing wrong, and I would like to leave. Finally, the canine unit gets there. The handler takes the dog. Dog walks around the car twice, sits down. Doesn't do anything, just sits down. Now the trooper and the canine handler talk a little bit, and the client hears the handler say, we ain't got shit.
Right.
Now the trooper goes over and says to the client, open the trunk. We have a hit. He goes, I have a hit. He said, you ain't got shit. He said, no, he said, we have a hit. He goes, no, shit, not hit. Shit, not hit. He goes, no, he said hit. Open the trunk. So now they force him to open the trunk, and they find, you know, a fairly sizable amount of anabolic steroids in there. Now,
right.
I wind up, you know, being a consultant on the case and getting involved in it. And, you know, there is at that time, and as far as I know to this day, there is no canine unit in the United States that's ever been trained to detect anabolic steroids.
Sure.
In theory, some of the synthetics maybe you could train the dog on, but I have yet to see that ever happen. And I've talked to many canine handlers. If there is one, if somebody knows of training, I'd like to see that documentation. But I've never seen it, and certainly at that time, it had never been done. And I asked everybody that I could find nationwide, and so it was kind of bogus. And I don't think the dog did hit. And when the client said, "Well, you said the dog would go crazy," he goes, "Ah, this is a different dog." I mean, it was just, you know, you couldn't win, right? So yeah. We wound up actually, the case went to trial, and so and ultimately, it even went on appeal. And it was ultimately determined that the case got thrown out. And one of the things that they did in it was I demanded to see, let's see the training records that show that dog was trained on steroids. Show me how reliable it is in the detection of an anabolic steroid. And the notes that they gave were simply a piece of paper with Winstrel written on it. It was like, I mean, come on. So ultimately, the case was favorably resolved, but it just shows you it was not a good window on law enforcement, and it does show you, I think, that even if you stand your ground and you make all the right decisions, and you can sometimes be thwarted. But you're always better off doing that, because at least we as lawyers, when the case comes to court, can make those arguments and we can fix it. I always say to people, Fifth Amendment says you don't have to incriminate yourself. Somebody
right.
comes up to you and says, Dylan, you got any steroids in the house? Do you mind if I search your car? Do you know what? You don't have to answer any of those questions. And so you can say, I appreciate you coming to my house. That's great, but I can't answer those questions. And the Sixth Amendment says that you have a right to an attorney before you answer the questions. So there's nothing wrong, and I tell everybody, there's nothing problematic about standing on the Constitution and saying, and I've had clients who've done it, When somebody comes to the door, two guys in suits, they show a badge. We're from DEA. We'd like to come in and we'd like to talk to you about some packages that we know you ordered. And look, we want to, you know, it's kind of cold out here on the stoop and your neighbors are looking. We should come in. Why don't you let us come in? Well, you have no obligation to let them in, to consent to their entering your home or conducting a search. And if you let them in, that's consent. So, you know, unless they have a warrant, in which case you got to let them in. But if they don't have a search warrant and don't show you a search warrant, you don't have to let them in. And you can simply say, I appreciate your coming, but I can't speak to you. My attorney handles all of this sort of thing for me. Here's his card. And I have a guy who actually put it through the little, you know, key slot, you know.
Yeah.
Here's my attorney, Rick Collins, smartest guy in the world. You're going to love him. He'll answer all your questions, but I can't let you in and I can't talk to you. That's his advice. Blame him, not me. And right. Closes the door. And so that is certainly the safest thing, because whatever you say in that conversation can be used against you.
Right.
So if you're asked the question, you know, have you ordered packages from China before? And you say, well, yes. Even if you're denying this package, you're giving some fuel that could be used. So when you think sometimes that you're talking your way out of it, you're not.
Right.
Let us as lawyers deal with the issues later in court, and just don't answer the questions. Don't make any confessions or any admissions. It's always best not to do that. And the other thing is, don't lie, because lying to federal agents is a crime in and of itself. You may remember Martha Stewart, the queen of home goods.
Right.
She went to prison for lying to federal agents. She didn't go to prison for any sort of impropriety in stock trades. She didn't do anything wrong. It was only and very often it's the cover-up that's the problem, bigger than the crime.
Right.
So by her lying to federal agents, she went to prison. So you never want to say, steroids, I don't use them. I don't know anything about that packet. Because if you continue sort of telling them lies, you can walk yourself into what's called a 1001 violation, which is a federal charge for people who lie to federal agents in the course of their investigations.
Got it. Let me ask you this real quick, just on my end, I guess, you know, like how I do videos that just discuss steroids and things like that. And, you know, I always get these questions, where's a good place to buy them? And, you know, all of this and that. And I've seen people actually do videos where they say, oh, I've used here and recommend there. And I tend to, well, first of all, I've gotten to the point where I try to steer people away from steroid use in general. But what, I mean, are there implications on just people doing videos or throwing a recommendation here or there or anything of that sort? Or is that kind of just like free speech?
Yeah. So, and that's a great question. And so it's funny. I'm in the process of co-authoring a piece on coaches, you know, steroid coaches.
Yeah.
Prep coaches who give programs and protocols for the use of performance-enhancing drugs to clients. Obviously, if you're providing the drugs, well, then you're a steroid dealer, right?
Well, yeah,
If you're just talking in theory and theoretical, well, here's the stuff that I've done and here's what you know a lot of guys do, that's probably free speech. And everything else is kind of in that spectrum in between, right? So yeah. Leading from, if you're giving somebody specific protocols, here's how much you use the first week and the second week and the third week. I guess there's some argument you're facilitating the use of steroids, although I think that's a stretch. There could be civil liability, though, because if that client has a heart attack and you know his wife finds your protocols and drugs in his nightstand and says, you son of a gun, you killed my husband. She's going to go to a lawyer and he's going to file a lawsuit against you, arguing that, you know, you were negligent
right.
in prescribing, you know, in recommending this stuff.
Sure.
And then it gets further on the spectrum is, well, I don't sell steroids, but here's the number of the guy that you should call. right? So you're kind of a steerer to that. In theory, I suppose, there's some sort of conspiratorial liability there, made worse if you're getting a kickback or any kind of money as a result of that transaction. Certainly, that would make it pretty clearly criminal. In the absence of that, it's kind of you're coming close. You know, it might be, you know, and I hate to use the word gray area, because gray area is kind of what people say to justify doing something that they know is probably wrong. Well, it was in a gray area. It's actually not a gray area. It's a discretionary enforcement area.
Right.
It's where the government, it's probably wrong and usually wrong.
Sure.
But the government usually doesn't do anything about it. It's kind of like in a 55 mile an hour zone, you're doing 60 miles an hour. Is that a gray area? Well, actually, no, it's right. Not a gray area. The speed limit is 55 and you're doing 60. Is right. Somebody going to stop you for it? Probably not.
Right.
You know, does everybody do it? Probably.
Sure.
You know, is it something that you're going to get in trouble for? Probably not. But, you know, it's not a gray area. It's just an enforcement discretion area.
Got it. Wrong guy, wrong day type of shit. I understand.
You know, and how many times, you know, do lawyers have clients who are like, you know, I got a ticket, I was doing 70 and people were blowing past me doing 80 and nobody stopped them. And here I have a ticket. Yeah, that can happen.
I know. All right, cool, man. So, all right, let's go. I've got a couple SARMs related questions for you. Also too, I'm curious because and this is through my experience with all of this, when I started to research SARMs and the first time that I, you know, really, really learned about them, this was when they first started. I'm talking 2012.
Right.
And I'm talking the only thing that you could even buy for research was MK2866, S4, and then very few sites had the MK677, and it was like $250 a bottle. I mean, it was insane. And it started to, you know, then the GW came out, then the LGD came out. But then when the pro-hormone ban hit, that's when everybody started to, like, oh my gosh, I'm stuck with all these, what can I do? Or I've been selling pro-hormones, let's start selling SARMs in capsules. And it went from kind of a nothing burger to,
right,
holy shit, it's everywhere. And that's right. When I feel like it got on the radar of FDA and law and everything. And that's from my observation. You would know better than me being on the legal side. Did you run into it? Cause a lot of people were spiking those too, putting pro hormones in them to get rid of them. I had worked for a supplement company that also, had a side company where they were doing pro hormones cause they were legal. And they were stuck with like $500,000 of raw materials and pro hormones. They could do, and they just took the L because they were on the right side of things, and they got screwed out of the money. But there were a lot of companies that were spiking SARMs. And so I guess my question is, did you run into a lot of problems around that pro hormone ban? And did you see a lot of companies that were, obviously you can't sell SARMs as supplements. That was insanity what was going on there. And they were in fucking GNC style shops and everything at that time. And they still are
from what I understand.
Are.
And I speak to clients who, you know, particularly down south in Texas, from what I understand, you can walk into any mom and pop nutrition store and buy a bottle of SARMs off the shelf. So, as far as pro hormones go, I wound up many years ago, there was a search warrant that was executed in Boise, Idaho, called the bodybuilding.com, which was a big online distributor of products and retailer. And so there were a bunch of pro hormone companies that were targeted in that search warrant. And I represented a whole bunch of those companies for making and selling pro hormones that were, you know, not compliant with the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, which is the law that makes supplements a category within food, within the overarching category of food. And so I represented a lot of people. And as that, if you remember, there was an anti-pro-hormone federal law that went into effect in 2004.
Yep.
And then there was one in 2014. And so the 2014 one kind of put the nail in the coffin of the pro-hormone market. And it was in the aftermath of that law that the SARMs market exploded. Because like we said before, if there's demand, there'll be supply. Exactly. And when the pro-hormones were no longer available for dudes who wanted to, you know, use gear light, you know, and not go fully to the dark side, SARMs became the thing, you know. And I sometimes say, when we look at drugs in general, and for example, narcotics, you can put all the laws into place you want for prohibition and for drug enforcement, but there's a certain percentage of the human genome that wants to get high. And whatever you do, whatever laws you put in place, that demand is going to be there. They're going to want to get high, and they're going to find a way to get high, frankly.
That's right.
And similar to that, there's a certain percentage of the human genome, typically men, who want to be jacked. And and they will find a way to be jacked. And so if it's not steroids, it'll be prohormones.
Right.
And if it's not prohormones, it'll be SARMs. And if it's not SARMs, there's something else down the pike.
Absolutely.
Because this is the demand. So so SARMs is sort of the thing of the day. And as you know, in 2018 and 2019, Congress expressed its understanding and that it knows what's going on, and actually floated out bills to make SARMs into the same Schedule III controlled substances that they made steroids into.
Totally.
And it's interesting because in the nutrition industry, a number of the trade groups were on board with that and saying, yeah, you know, these SARMs, they don't comply with the law of dietary supplements. They shouldn't be on the market. And so we're okay with making them into controlled substances. I was not. And I was probably the lone fly in the ointment for that, and expressed it often to the trade groups that it's nice to say these things shouldn't be on the market because they don't comply with the supplement law, selling them as supplements.
Right.
But when you make something a controlled substance, you're not only criminalizing the person who's selling them, you're criminalizing the person who's possessing them.
Exactly.
So some guy who bought a bottle of SARMs a month before this law goes into effect is now a federal drug criminal. And if that's found in his car or in his house, he's now subject to arrest and prosecution. Absolutely. I think the drug war has failed generally in many ways. I think the drug war has not been successful on many levels. And if you measure it on a whole lot of different criteria, it's done a lot of harm compared to the amount of good that it's done.
I agree.
To now, and a lot of people are recognizing that, and the war on drugs has been scaled back dramatically. Where now we've enacted new policies in many jurisdictions to scale back the length of time that people go into prison for drug crimes, to find other diversion programs to avoid prison for people. So that the war, I think there's even many in law enforcement have come to realize we may have gone too far with the war on drugs. So now to take SARMs, which have no addictive or hallucinogenic qualities, and make them into the same act with heroin and cocaine, and make people who are law-abiding, fitness-related people into federal drug criminals, to me was insane. And so, and I said that regularly. And ultimately, I think, you know, both of those bills that were floated out in those 2 years were, you know, died on the vine. Whether Congress will ever try to go forward with it again, to me, if you don't, you know, there are laws that can simply be enforced. If you're selling SARMs as supplements, and I've written about this so much, I've told people they're not supplements. You know, you can't sell you know, ostarine does not qualify as a vitamin, as a mineral, as an herb. I mean, we can go through the list, right? So it's not a component of the kind of foods that we eat in our ordinary day. So so that you can't do. And we don't need any new laws to allow the DEA to go after it.
No, that was Senator Hatch, I believe, that was in Utah, was one of those guys, because I remember looking at everything, and he ended up retiring, and it just never progressed anywhere. I actually paid close attention to that, obviously, with videos and stuff that I was covering at the time. But yeah, it's always something that could pop up when any, whatever they do with pharmaceutical companies. I know GSK and GlaxoSmithKline has a big thing in that, and it's all about the money and whatever the case may be. But what kind of, because, okay, several things here. I pay attention to everything SARMs and peptides, research chemical related, because I like to stay on the up and up, because I like to put out reviews on companies. I like to call out nonsense. And it's just good for my channel, for my videos, because I need topics. I'm out of fucking topics. I've been doing this a decade, so I got to get good shit. So I, one of the things I've noticed that I cannot for the life of me fathom they are getting away with at some of these places is they're putting, I've seen several of these places selling aromatase inhibitors, selling, Clomid, Novadex, selling Viagra, Cialis. But then I'm seeing some that have fucking clenbuterol, HCG. Like, it blew your mind. And I could easily show you, because I documented it. And I'm just like, because I've seen some that have been taken down recently that were in trouble, but they didn't even have some of this stuff on there. How is that possible? And what kind of penalties do you see on some of these companies that are, you know, breaking the law or getting in trouble? And also, what do they look for in terms of compliancy and non-compliancy? Is it the marketing? Because I see a lot of people that have like Facebook ads that show bodybuilders on them. Clearly you can't do that. And some of the sites that have been around forever, they don't do any of that stuff. They're very compliant. They're very picky with what they do. It's a very scientific website with not a lot of rah-rah on it and everything. Right. Like a peptide science, for example, that's like a, you know, generic, whatever the case may be.
But they'll often say it's not for human use.
Sure. Yeah. They've been doing that for.
Which is a problem.
Right.
Because, you know, the facts will often show, if the government can dig, they will find facts that show that that's just bullshit.
Right.
Right. And once they show that, then it becomes fraud. And so they prosecute those cases on a theory of fraud.
Got it.
The fraud being that every transaction that is made with the fraudulent component that it's not for human use to a person who obviously bought it to use it is a transaction that goes to an overall number of transactions and a number of dollars. And those dollars is the standard. We talked in steroid cases that the punishment is based on the number of steroid units, right?
Right.
In these sorts of peptide cases, because they're not controlled and because they're prosecuted not as drug cases, but as fraud cases, the basis is the amount of dollars. So if you make $100,000 selling peptides, ancillary drugs, whatever, Viagra, under a fraudulent guise of research, then you're facing one level of potential range of punishment. If you make $1 million or $5 million selling it, well, then your punishment is much, much higher under the federal sentencing guidelines. And these cases are typically prosecuted as the introduction of misbranded drugs into interstate commerce with the intent to defraud and mislead. They'll often use a conspiracy theory and a conspiracy charge. They'll sometimes charge mail fraud, because every bottle of product that's put in the mail is pursuant to this fraud. So you get a mail fraud. You can be charged with money laundering, because every dollar that you take in and from this illegal proceeds and put into making a car payment or into a bank account or whatever, that's laundering the money, right? So you have all of those theories that are attached to be able to allow prosecutors to prosecute these people. In general terms, I can say that in the very beginning, and I had probably the very first cases like this with clients who were selling, you know, erectile dysfunction drugs, anti-estrogens, various ancillaries, maybe Clen, other stuff, even before peptides were really out there. But the theory is the same, whether it's peptides or these other things, it's the fraud in calling it not for human use.
Got it.
So back in those days, I was able to kind of either negotiate a corporate plea or a corporate felony, and maybe the owner took a misdemeanor. They really didn't know too much about it on the government. Now they're much more sophisticated.
Right.
And so now they're typically looking for prison time on these cases. I just had one recently that I was able to resolve without any prison time. Most of the time I've been able to avoid prison on these cases because I've developed a quiver of arrows that I can shoot in the way of legal arguments that will confound and perplex my adversaries to the point where I'm able to resolve things, years ago, if you may be too young to remember, but years ago there was GHB was criminalized by in 2000 by Bill Clinton, and there were analogs of GHB that then kind of flooded the market, not just GBL, but things like the 1,4 butane diol.
Yeah.
And so these things would be sold under kind of fraudulent circumstances. So it would be sold, let's say, as a floor cleaner. And there was a product that was labeled as a floor cleaner, but it was in a bottle that you'd need 10 of them to clean your floor. You couldn't afford to clean your floor. Right? So, and it was clear that it was being sold for the purposes of people using it. And the government looks at everything. It looks at how it's labeled, how it's marketed, who's buying it, who's it being sold to. If there were emails, what do the emails from the customers say to inform the distributor or person who's selling it that they're using it. And so I was up against a prosecutor who was extremely aggressive, and she wanted this guy to go. She was furious and wanted this guy to go to prison so badly. My position was that the relationship of that particular substance to GHB was not sufficiently close for it to qualify as an analog under the analog statute, which requires chemical and pharmacological relationship. And so her argument was it could be either chemical or pharmacological. She was wrong. And ultimately we battled it in court and the judge went my way, and that made her even more furious. Oh, sure. And then I asked for a hearing on whether the law was subject to a void for vagueness argument. In other words, if a law is so vague that nobody knows, is this legal or not legal? Well, then it's void for vagueness.
Right.
And she said, well, that's ridiculous. You don't get a hearing on that. The judge grants me the hearing. So now she goes even crazier. So I call the chairs of two different chemistry departments as witnesses to explain why these molecules are not sufficiently similar, that that chemical structural similarity just isn't there, plus that the pharmacological effects are not sufficiently similar. And she called a chemist from the DEA. I was able to cross-examine him very effectively. And the judge actually dismissed the indictment. And she went craziest of all. And I remember her calling my office and leaving a message on my office one night. It's a Sunday night, and I want you to know, I'm in my office and I'm answering your papers. I'm answering your complaints, and I'm not with my family where I should be. It was the crazy. I wish I had saved it. And ultimately, the other districts dealt with the same issue in other circuits around the country. And unfortunately, I wasn't involved in those cases. And I think had I been, it might have gone differently. But the lawyers in some of those cases didn't articulate the arguments in the way that I did. And the cases all went the other way on this debatable issue. And sure. So when it went up on appeal, the courts looked at all those other precedents at the appellate level and said, we got to go with those. So right. They kicked the case back on appeal. Okay. I show up for the court date and she's not there. It's a new male assistant U.S. attorney. He's like, well, I'm on the case now. I'm like, okay, well, what do we want to do? He goes, what do you want? I said, I want probation. He goes, done. And that was it. We did probation. You know, a lot of my clients, and I'll say this, and then I actually got a phone message of somebody who's just been raided. So I actually have to get off and answer it. I'm a busy, busy boy with this stuff. But I'm very busy on social media, and you and I are connected. Rick Collins, ESQ on Instagram. I try to keep everybody posted with whatever developments. The things that what your viewers watch you for is kind of the same stuff that I write about and post about. So if you want to stay abreast of all that stuff, Rick Collins, ESQ on Instagram is a good way. Please follow me.
Yes.
But like that client and many of my clients, years ago, I represented the chemist in the Balco case, which you may remember. So
totally.
So I've had like all these clients. And my clients typically become my friends, and they become my followers on social media, and I interact with them, you know, on Facebook or Instagram, and so I'm very, you know, I'm a lot of my clients send other clients recommendations from past clients is means a lot to me. I'm I'll finish with this. I'm just feeling I'm very, very blessed to be able to do what I do, to have the unique skill set. I never saw it coming. When I was a competitive bodybuilder, I never imagined that I'd be practicing law in this area because it didn't even exist then. There was no such thing. And I think to this day, I'm the only guy who does it. But if somebody is accused of something involving any of the stuff that we've talked about, and, you know, you could go with a local lawyer who's going to feel his way through it. But, you know, most of my clients will say, and you can go to some of my legal reviews and stuff. Most of my clients will say it was the best phone call they ever made.
Totally. Totally. Well, I'll make sure that I have all of your information in the link in the descriptions here, and we'll post the shit out of this because this is going to be a highlight video for me and for everybody to watch. I really, really, truly appreciate the time. This was not only enlightening, but it was just damn fun for me. It's a great conversation with you, very like-minded, and I really value this time. I can't wait to do this part two with you because you and I both talked about this. We're both going to go off on this one. It's going to be hell of a lot of fun. You are the man, Rick. I appreciate your time. And I, like I said, I look forward to speaking a ton with you more in the future. So everybody, Rick Collins, make sure you follow him on Instagram, and I will post everything in the description. That being said, stay tuned for plenty more to come. Dylan Jamelli and Rick Collins signing off.
Thanks, bro.